Accession number 11105, Colonel M. McBain, Reel 11.
Colonel M. McBain, Reel 11. How did you heat your food and cook it in the trench?
Well, each platoon had its own cook, but who was provided by the battalion. I mean, he appeared from the battalion. And we had a number one burner, which the British armies had, goodness knows when. It's a petrol burner, which makes a fiendish noise. It's just a petrol blowtorch, but very, very effective. And you you dig a little trench, and you have this burner at one end, and you pump it up, fill it up with petrol, and pump it up, and light it. And this jet of flame shoots out along the trench, which has a metal framework in it, with holes in the top of the metal frame, and you put cooking utensils, aluminium cooking utensils on the top of that, with your potatoes and your meat and your vegetables and so on. No, I mean, you fed very well. You actually ate out of your mess tins, or if you'd beaten the system, you managed to smuggle up some plates in, tin plates or something, you ate off those. Cutlery and so on.
Were you finding in those early days that there were men in your platoon who were particularly good at picking things up?
Oh, yes, yeah. As time went on, you all got better at it. I mean, this first time in the line was all very new for all of us. I'll now speak very briefly about an upsetting part of this. I don't know how long we were in the line that time, a month. I think we were probably in for a month or just less. But I hadn't realised there was no way of knowing, and there was no indication. But Sergeant Hannah, whether it was a result of the Second World War in the jungle or whatever, was very, very nervous. Because we were in the reserve company position, and I was probably every third night going out on patrol of one sort or another, we'd share the night shift. He'd take half and I'd take half. I didn't notice it for a couple of nights. And then suddenly I was woken up by a tremendous fire. Oh, Christ. So I leapt out and went out. And in fact, it was Sergeant Hannah with a couple of the guys firing into the wilderness. And I said, What is it? I mean, we were all sort of had our hair standing on end. In fact, I mean, as far as we could tell, there was nothing there. But this became a bit of a habit, and after that first time in the line, I had to say to the company commander, I'm sorry, but Sergeant Hannah has got to go. I can't stand this. Now that he's not doing the platoon any good either. And it was a shame, because he was a nice man, and obviously, you know, had done quite well during the war. But he was upsetting the whole platoon. And so, as I say, after that spell in the line, again, as a platoon commander, one wasn't aware of the mechanics of all this. I just mentioned to Reggie. Because, strangely enough, it must have been a very strange, funny position, because nobody else heard this. I was expecting all hell to break out from Reggie and even battalion, saying, what's going on? But nobody appeared to hear it. And when I said to Reggie, you know, we appear to have a bit of a problem, that's funny, I haven't heard anything. And very few people heard. However, I assured them it had happened. And so he was moved to another company after that spell in the line. And sadly, very early on the next time back in the line with that other company, he walked into a minefield and lost a leg, which didn't do me much good. However, that was that.
And he would be replaced.
This was after we'd come out of the line. We came out of the line and went back into some sort of, we'd go back into bivouac areas where it was still wasn't proper winter. So it still wasn't very cold. And we would be living in bivouac, two-man bivouac tents and 160-pounder tents as a company in a company bivouac area, where you would try to organise sort of hot showers and hot water and this sort of thing to the best as best you can, and the naffy, and you'd try to make a little canteen for the boys and an officer's mess for the company. But you lived as a company. But there was, the other companies were nearby, and you would mingle and mix and so on, but there was a battalion headquarters mess, but you tended to stick in your own company mess. And when you were out, you were cleaning yourselves up, refurbishing, and as you say, it was just First World War stuff, a bit of retraining or practice.
Any chance for leisure?
Not
activities.
Not at this stage, but eventually, it must have started fairly early on, but I can't remember when, everyone in Korea had the great rest and recuperation, which was an American invention, R&R, which involved 5 days in Japan. Was it this time out of the line? Or the next time. At one time, fairly early on, I was asked by the commander to Incheon, where the Commonwealth were thinking of setting up a leave centre, a local leave centre. And so I went, and I had two or three days there, I think. And it was a very comfortable, basically it was Korean buildings, although they're probably brick, but they had thatch roofs, I think, with Korean staff, basically, but it was obviously a camp commandant, and it wasn't at all bad, and I think people did go there. I didn't go back there, but I think people did go there just for a break.
Were you getting mail?
Oh, yes. I mean, mail was very regular, airmail. I don't know how long it took, let's say 5 days. I mean, it really was very quick.
And were you having to censor your mail letters?
No. Because, you know, it didn't mean anything to anybody. I mean, if Geordie wrote that we're now in whatever the name of the place was, the Chinese knew we were there, we knew the Chinese were there. You know, there was no sense to it. We would take the opportunity, I think, to have sports when we were out. I do remember one memorable occasion when we had a battalion rifle meeting. And I'm not sure this wasn't the first time out or the second time out. We couldn't really believe this, but no, a battalion rifle meeting. And there weren't any rifle ranges as such. But something had been constructed. I think we had more casualties in the butts there than we had in the line, because the bullets were all going all over the place and splinters. And we certainly had people hurt during this rifle meeting, but joy of joys, 5 platoon won the platoon competition. How, I don't know, because, you know, we weren't renowned for our expertise. However, we did, we won this, and when it was announced and I was about to step forward, Peter Jeffries, the CO, said, "I'm very pleased about this because I commanded 5 platoon for 12 years in 1930-something. So that perked me up a bit. But anyway, we did all these sort of things. We tended, whenever the opportunity arose, to play with the tanks, if there were any about. We would play with the guns. If
when you say play, is that mean?
Well, exercise with the tanks. Just in case someone decided we were going to move somewhere.
Did you get any opportunity to work with the air arm?
No. No, there were forward air observers. If there was anything going, we used to see quite a lot of airstrikes. The interesting thing was that if there was going to be anything, any airstrike near us for some reason, we would be withdrawn, out of the front line, shooting back for about half a mile, or we'd all put our tin hats on, because nobody knew where these bombs were going to go. And there'd be these tremendous crumps and wallops and bangs, and great clouds of smoke and dust and flames. Then we'd all go back and see if we could see what had happened. Probably more accurate were the Navy had an aircraft carrier off the west coast, and they were fireflies, little bombers, fighters, or bombers, I think. And fireflies used to, the Americans were flying jets, and the Canadians and the South Africans, there was a South African squadron flying jets. But the Royal Navy Fleet Air Arm had these petrol driven fireflies, and they were great because, of course, they were going at the proper speed. And if they were going to drop a bomb, by and large, they dropped it where they thought they were going to drop it, whereas the jets were whizzing around all over the place. And their bombs could go anywhere. Despite, we had air panels, fluorescent panels showing where we were and all the rest of it. But we used to withdraw.
Did you experience any shells or bombs dropping on you from your own side?
Yes. Yes, I later, when was it? Was it when I was still with, no, I'd actually left B Company. But at one stage, yes, B Company headquarters was the subject of an artillery bombardment. And nobody could work out what this was, who was firing it. It was clearly on from us. It wasn't coming that way. It was coming from behind. And it took literally 20 minutes, half an hour, to find out who it was. What had happened was we were the right forward battalion of the Commonwealth Division. Our next-door neighbours was the South Korean Division. And for some reason, the Canadian Artillery Regiment was in support of the Korean battalion. To our left were the Black Watch of the British Brigade, the 28th Brigade. And they were having a battle, the famous Battle of the Hook, where they, it is now a battle honour. They got it as a battle honour. So it was quite a big battle, although it was company level. But it was going on, and all the divisional British Commonwealth divisional artillery was involved right the way down from top to bottom, except this Canadian battery, and they felt left out, and so they thought they'd join in. But they got the range a bit wrong, and they were dropping straight on to Reggie and his company headquarters, and He was getting very anxious. In fact, but it just goes to show there was no damage. I think he got some soot down his chimney and he got his mist in debt here, but that was about all, really.
No casualties.
No.
When you're still in this reserve company position in the line, you said you were you had to find patrols.
Yes.
What form did they take, preparation-wise and...
Yes, I mean, patrolling, of course, certainly for the reserve, two reserve companies normally, was, I mean, that was your job. And it was the usual mixture of recce, ambush, or fighting patrols. They were the standard types. The standing patrols were normally whichever company it was. But the recce, fighting, or ambush were normally platoon size. Recce patrols obviously were probably four people. Radio operator and a couple of guys. Yes.
What does that particular type of patrol do?
The job of the recce patrols in Korea really was to find out if necessary. One that I did was to find out whether a particular... We had... One of the forward companies, the OPs, had seen something on the Chinese hillside that they thought was a position, was a gun pit or weapon pit or something that was occupied from time to time, or appeared to be occupied from time to time. And so somebody wanted to know what it was. And so I was told to go and have a look.
In your preparation for this, how were you dressed? I assume this would be a nighttime episode. So how were you dressed?
Well, if we go right through, Harry, I mean, I would be warned. From memory, I think I was given 2 days' notice. By the company command, by Reggie, and then the battalion IO would tell me the tale. And we went to the forward company to have a look at this thing. And then to work out routes to and from, because obviously you try to have a different route. All that planning was done by myself with the IO. The route out and the route in. And I would have picked the people to come with me, radio operator and a couple of tough guys. I would show them. Take them forward to see where we were going. We would then practice in our own immediate area during the day what we would do if we contacted the enemy, what we'd do when we got to the place, what we'd do on the way back, and what we'd do if we were caught, or, you know, this sort of thing. We rehearsed. And then I'd been given a time out and a time back, and in due course you would dress. And as I say, it wasn't very cold, and so I think we just wore a combat jacket and trousers, boots, cap comforter, woolen hat. I think we did blacken our faces. More for good measure than anything else, I think. Anyway, I had a Sten gun. In fact, we all had Sten guns. The radio operator had an 88 set, which was a doubtful value. However, sometimes it worked.
Was it very cumbersome to carry?
The 88 set? No, it was... it really, I think, was the first proper infantry set. It fitted into two pouches on the belt, like your ammunition pouches, with the batteries on one side and the radio on the other. No, it was very easy. Wasn't heavy at all. It was just technology at that stage wasn't all that great. To be fair, they did normally work, but you could have problems. And you would go off whenever you were told to go off. In this particular case, I think it was last light. And so we got up into the forward company position in daylight. And we had something to eat there, I think. And then as soon as it was dark, we went out through one of their forward platoons, through one of their standing patrols. Their standing patrol went out first through the wire. And normally your standing patrols were on minefield gaps. There were gaps through the minefields, which were marked with wire and triangles. And the standing patrols tended to be on the enemy side of the wire, of the barbed wire, and at a minefield gap, because they knew where, the enemy knew where they were as well as we did. And if he was going to come to see us, he would have to come through there. And so the forward company standing patrol would go out, and then we would go out and pass through them, through the wire, and through the minefield. And that was always slightly anxious, because if the wire had been knocked down during the day by a shell or something, you know, if it was very dark, you'd be following the wire, and suddenly it wasn't there.
If it was dark, were you following it by touch?
Oh, yes, yeah, yeah. And if the wire wasn't there, then a slight problem. I was always lucky. I always had one. I never lost both. And you come out on the other side, and on you went. And a recce patrol, obviously, your aim was to avoid contact. And so if you heard or saw anything, you would stop and let it all pass, whatever it was.
It must have been somewhat difficult, though. This is night time. Obviously, you can't see too far. There are noises. How did you deal with all this kind of incoming audio?
This, of course, was, I suppose, without being pompous about it, is what you trained to do. You had trained right the way from Sandhurst onwards. It was the noises that were the difficult things. But, I mean, that applied all the way through my army service. I mean, wherever you were, in the jungle or in the desert or wherever it was, there were always strange noises. And until you became familiar, until you were able to identify, I mean, going across these paddy fields, as I say, the first thing was the Vickers covering fire, because, again, when you were going out, they would tend to have some harassing tasks somewhere to cover any noise you might make going through the wire and so on. So Vickers and possibly the 3-inch mortars would fire. But then, I mean, there were still frogs in the paddy field and rats and quite apart from anything else, pheasants, all sorts of things out there, quite apart from Chinamen.
What was the drill if you felt there was something? Did you freeze?
Oh, yeah, you stopped dead and just froze.
Didn't fling yourself down, anything of that nature?
No, you just stopped dead. I mean, obviously, depending on what it was. I, in fact, had one incident where I was out on a recce, and we heard... this certainly wasn't Vickers machine gun bullets landing in the paddy field. This was people padding, because each paddy field, rice field, is divided by a wall, an earth wall called a bund. And these were the tracks you moved on. You didn't walk across the paddy field because you would be up to your waist in clout. So you moved along these wall paddy buns. And this was clearly two or three people padding along a paddy bun. We, in fact, did get down into this kind of stinking clout at the side of this paddy bun. And we were in the field, and the paddy bun was... our heads were really up against it. And a foot above us, three Chinamen padding along this paddy field. And they didn't appear to be armed. And they were whistling away. And off they went. They came from left to right, and they had disappeared. Now what? Maybe they were doing the same as we were doing. But they weren't doing it so well as we were. Because they clearly had no idea we were there.
How close had you to get to be able
To do the job.
Do the job, yes.
To fulfill your mission, as they say. My job in this particular case was to find out whether that what it was and whether it was actually occupied when we were there. In fact, it wasn't, and it was a gun pit.
So you went into it, did you?
Well, we went right up to it eventually, and it was empty. It was an OP or something. It had no permanent fixtures. It was a hole in the ground with a roof over the soil roof over the top. You know, it wasn't a very strong structure. It was an OP. I reported it as an OP. Why they'd want an OP? Because it wasn't at the bottom. It was sort of halfway up their hill. When they could see for miles from the top of the hill. I don't know what. This is one of the things I suppose which has gone on ever since. They've been what the other side's up to. They obviously had a very good reason for doing it, but I couldn't think what it was. And then we came back, bearing in mind your schedule, and you had to get back through another minefield gap, which you had to find.
It's been difficult.
Well, you're on compass navigation. If it's very dark, you hoped it was fairly dark, actually. And you were navigating by compass. You were on bearings and paces. The heroes with you were counting paces and this sort of thing. And you hoped you hit this gap, and obviously sometimes you didn't. But you came to the minefield. Why? You would then have to decide whether you went left or right to find the gap. All this takes time.
In that situation, did you all, in effect, move in one direction?
Oh, we were all together. No, we stuck together. There's no question of breaking up.
And you went back a different route?
Yes, you've come back in a different route.
Was there some special reason for that?
Well, if a Chinese patrol had seen you going out through the gap, they might think you would come back and they could ambush that gap. So you try to find another one to come back in. And then you would come up against your own, or not, the company standing patrol at the friendly end.
And was this and on a challenge? And
yes, hold who? Why me? It's Judy, you bugger, and all this sort of thing. Passwords came and went. Some of the passwords, like alone Geordie, they were 10 from America or Australia. You'd sing a burst of blatant races or something. And you'd come back in, and then straight the boyos would go home, and I would go probably to the IO. He might come to meet me, depending on what was going on. He may be in the forward company. Or I'd go and debrief me, and I'd go home to bed.
What effect had this on your stamina and your nerves? I mean, it must have been a very hard.
Oh, yes. You were getting tireder, obviously. It was a cumulative thing, I think. We were all pretty young and fit, and provided you didn't have any alarms and excursions, it was... as I say, it was what you trained to do and what you did. But, you were tired. Like young things anywhere, you go to bed and sleep, a big breakfast, and away you go.
You weren't free from any kind of duties there. You couldn't rest.
No, because you were troop commander and you carried on with a normal team. Until two or three nights later when you went out again. And it may have been, it only happened to me once, that as a result of a recce patrol, you then set up an ambush or something, result of your own recce. I never did it, which the object was to capture a prisoner.
Was it a great relief when you were actually back, to know that you were where you were, back
home?
Oh,
yes, I always get home. Oh, yes. I don't think it was anywhere near the same. The tension, for example, I don't know, in the Second World War, of, let's say, a bomber crew every second night or third night getting into that bomber and going off to Berlin or Hamburg or somewhere and then coming back again. What must have been strange for them, I think, was coming back to a completely normal life, to sheets in the bed and living in a mess and going out to the pub in the evening for a drink. I think the strain on that strain must have been very, very difficult. I don't think we were...